Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Abby, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
I feel like I learned so much this week. I went to a conference and I'm like brimming with incredible knowledge.
It was more a symposium than a conference.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Is there a difference?
No.
So, but it was interesting. We saw some cool stuff. We saw some...
Not so cool.
So, yeah, but...
John and I sat through.
It's good to get refreshed about this stuff because you get to see different perspectives.
Well, it's also really nice to watch things grow.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this was much smaller, and there obviously is an interest in learning about the scientific stuff behind mental health and addiction.
I'm fascinated by that stuff, and we're talking about addiction tonight. We're talking about moms and alcohol, and... We have two guests joining us. Jowita Bydlauska is the author of Drunk Mom, a brutally honest memoir of motherhood in the shadow of alcoholism.
It is amazing.
It is amazing.
That book, I mean, the book was just overwhelmingly, you know, took you for a ride.
And well written, too.
Yes, like, very well written. And we also have Tyler H., a Boston mom, who will share her personal story of mothering through alcoholism as well as her path to recovery.
First, we'll start with Jowita. After the birth of her son, Jowita Bydlauska found herself celebrating with a glass of champagne. And just like that, her 3 years of sobriety were a distant memory, and she began the rapid slide back to full-blown alcoholism. In her new book, Drunk Mom, Bydlauska tells the brutally honest story of her fight to stop drinking while facing the daunting reality of becoming a mom. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, Jowita.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
I just want to say, hi, I'm Abby. And I, when reading this book, it was one of the most beautifully written descriptions of addiction that I've ever read. And I've read a lot because of my field. And it was just, it really made people understand, if they read it, it'll make people understand what you wanted and what you did were totally different. And we'd like to have you read. You want to set it up, John?
Yeah, you're talking about alcoholism, you're talking about drinking, you're comparing them. Could you set that up?
Yeah, I'm just going to read a short paragraph, page 14. People also tend to mistake alcoholism for drinking. I'm going to slow down, cut down on my drinking. Okay, you do that. But if you're an alcoholic, you can't just do that. Alcoholism is not drinking, just like hemophilia is not bleeding. You can't slow down, cut down on your alcoholism. You can't unlearn its language. You can stop using it and forget some of the words, but you still know it. With drinking, too, you can stop drinking and hope it will stay stopped. Alcoholism is a habit, a permanent condition of having the habit, like this wanting is, at least in my case. Sometimes the wanting gets too strong and I run. I run with it, run so fast, I'm out of breath, and then run even faster. And you told me to set it up, so to put it in a context.
Yeah.
Earlier in this chapter, I talk about how I compare alcoholism to your first native language. My first language is Polish, and I learned English when I was a teenager, but I will always be the speaker of my native language. So whenever I go to Poland, I pick it up just like that, and I'm fluent in it. So that's what I compare alcoholism to. Sort of more than a disease, more than a habit, kind of, you know, more mental than physical. That's what it was like for me.
I'm wondering, Jowita, if you had this kind of insight at the time this was happening, or this is kind of something that came later, but because it seems so insightful about, I've rarely heard it really put better, the kind of the difference. And I was wondering if you really had that insight when you were in it, or did that come later?
That's a great question. I think I did. I knew what was going on. I could feel it, and you know, it was kind of instinctive. I could describe what was happening to me, and I tried to describe it to my, you know, loved ones who were asking me what was going on and why I couldn't snap out of it. While I was in my addiction, so I certainly was aware of what was going on. So that's one thing. But at the same time, it wasn't until I was sober that I was able to actually put it in words and, you know, write it down and get that sort of next level of insight. So yes and no.
Yeah.
So we wanted you to read the reading on page 20, the first two paragraphs. But we also wanted, and then we want to hear some of your, and then it's like the beginning of your story, and we'd love to hear your story.
Sure. Well, just to intro, so the book is called Drunk Mom. It is specifically about my relapse after having my son, and I wrote this chapter sort of tongue-in-cheek, not entirely, but to sort of talk about what motherhood was like. It's a big, heavy metaphor, but it was fun to write, and hopefully it'll be fun to read it out loud to your readers. Motherhood. Here's how it is. One day I wake up, and it turns out that I am now the head of a country. A whole country. Imagine that. What happens is that I have been given a crown one very painful morning, and now the entire country depends on me. Not only that, but because of my genetic makeup, it is obvious to everyone around me that I will naturally know how to rule this country, how to feed it and protect it from disasters and attacks, how to make its people happy. As the genetically designated and designed monarch, it is expected of me that I will know exactly what to do with the little people who depend on me, that my nature will dictate how to help them and feed them and clothe them. To help me rule it properly, I have been given a gift, an endless supply of food that the country's people live on. I'm also given a generous pension for ruling this country, free money that comes every 2 weeks from the government. The king, there is a king, insists that I am given this money to do my job as the ruler. It is precisely why I have been given this money by the government, me and not him. He is right. Not only that, to prove myself as a worthy ruler, I have been given a whole year off from my other duties that usually involve sitting in a windowless office and typing on a computer. It's also strongly suggested I put my own duties, such as writing novels and taking photographs, on hold. The things that take up time and bring no money and do absolutely nothing for the good of the country. Now, I know that because I live in Canada, so when I was on mat leave, I got a whole year of pension from the government. So this is what this money is referring to. So
yes,
for being a parent in Canada, you get paid every 2 weeks. So it's.
Well, I'm sitting here in the studio with three mothers,
and
I'm not a mother. But I just reading that when I read that, it just from hearing the talk and all that as a man, it just struck me as such a wonderful, like it let me inside the mind of a mother in a way that I never had been. I just think it's just wonderful.
Thanks.
Can you tell us a little about your story?
Sure. I don't know when I became an alcoholic. From the first drink, I'm one of those. I mean, my first drink was, it was a blackout drink. So red flags all over right from the get-go. But it was a lot of fun for a long time. I partied a lot in my undergrad years at university. And it was around the age of 27 where, there's saying in 12-step groups that common denominator of alcohol, which is when, a lot of bad things were happening, lost relationship, losing my job, and possibly not having a place to live, and the common denominator being alcohol and my drinking. So that was around the time when I realized that, it was a problem. I went to my first AA meeting, and I stayed sober for 3.5 years, and it was great. I got everything back. I got my apartment back. I got back together with my boyfriend who dumped me. Got this amazing job working for a magazine, being an editor for a magazine. So it was going really well. And then I became pregnant, and I had a baby. And shortly after I had him, I relapsed. And so the book talks about the 11-month relapse right after I had my son. The insanity of addiction and trying to stay sober and not being able to stay sober. I mean, I went right back to where I was when I first quit drinking. There was no, there was no grace period. I was immediately, an alcoholic.
So you were well aware of what was going on. It wasn't like you just kind of stumbled across a drinking problem,
no,
after your child was born.
No, I mean, and I know there's, many different types of addicts, alcoholics. You know, there's the educational variety where you kind of teach yourself to drink problematically, and then there's ones like myself who, you know, like there's something missing or there's something extra in my brain. I just immediately become addicted. So yeah, I mean, there was no stumbling into it. It was full on. But you know, any addiction, I mean, the huge part of it is the self-denial and lying and secrets, right? So that's only
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about those dark days for you and the kind of the deception that you carry on with your the people around you and the battle that you fight with yourself and the guilt and the shame. And we also have our friend Tyler H. in here who shares some of the same story. Yuita, where we left off was that you had this baby and you had this relapse. And can you walk us through kind of a typical day in that 11 months you're describing?
What a great question. Well, I mean, typical day would be me taking care of an infant, so whatever that entails, you know, waking up and feeding him and dressing him, and then going for a walk. And, you know, my alcoholism progressed during those 11 months, so I would start, if we were to look at my walks, perhaps, it would start with me having this nice walk in the morning and then one in the afternoon, one in the evening, perhaps. I was quite restless, and I walked everywhere. And then I would drink after I would put my baby to bed. So usually around 9 p.m. I would be mommy's time. But with time, I started purchasing alcohol, earlier and having sips here and there during my walks. And then I tried not to do that, and it became just this insane cycle. There's a lot of repetition in my book, and the reason for that is I wanted to actually illustrate the way, you know, a typical day of an alcoholic looks like. In my case, you know, in a context of being a new mom, but I think it's pretty similar, just that sort of repetition, trying to, you know, stay off whatever it is that you're addicted to, and then doing it, and then feeling guilty, and then doing it, you know, again, over and over. I mean, that's, every day was typical, and then it was the same day every day.
Groundhog Day, but not in a good sort of way.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I want to bring Tyler into this conversation. Tyler, when she talks about that repetition and the same, it's the same day but a different day over and over and over again, can you tell us a little about your story?
Yeah, I mean, that is something that I completely identify with. And Abby, you had mentioned Groundhog Day. That was the first analogy that sprang to my mind. I think one of the things that really spoke to me in the book as well was that sense of restlessness and urgency, but at the same time, it was just the same insanity over and over again every day, and just the sort of mapping out and plotting of, you know, how am I going to get my alcohol? How am I going to dispose of the bottles? And, you know, it was just this really horrible cycle that you just couldn't break.
And all the time, you're caring for two teeny little kids, right? Your kids are very close.
I actually was taking care of three.
Wow.
It didn't go well.
No, it didn't. I mean, like most alcoholics, my my disease progressed. Mine took a little bit longer. My alcoholic drinking really was over a 10-year period. And so for me, it was really the last year where it was very, very bad. And it got to the point where I was actually not functioning all that well.
Why is it easy for mothers to fall into this pattern? Like, what makes this kind of population different than the average working woman, you know, woman who's devoting her whole day to her career and working instead of the mother who's at home with the kids?
Well, in my case, I had come from a really big corporate career, and I had these wonderful children. I had a wonderful husband, a wonderful house, and it was almost as if I had golden handcuffs in a way. My first two children were 12 months apart, which was I don't even know how to describe
insane.
It. The first year, yeah, it was insane. And the first year was really kind of a blur. I mean, my first child was not walking when my second child came home from the hospital. And, you know, I had to stop breastfeeding the first child because I was pregnant with the second, and I couldn't breastfeed the second child because I couldn't manage. I had this little child who was learning how to walk. I couldn't be breastfeeding for hours a day. So it was just really a question of getting through, and it was kind of putting one foot in front of the other. But there was also this great sense of isolation. You know, here I was with this wonderful home, and, you know, the picture that I had painted was really beautiful, but the reality was I was very much alone and very isolated. And I think one of the things that was also in the second year for me, my entire day was a nap for a year.
Somebody was napping.
Somebody was
napping. And not
you. And not me. And I couldn't even go grocery shopping. I mean, I had to rely on Peapod. So I was never even getting out of the house. So it was, I don't know if that really answers your question, but that was what my experience was.
Mm-hmm. So Yoida, you talk about leaving, you know, being the queen, the head of this country, which I thought was one of the most beautiful things. You know, so many people I know left, you know, had to leave careers at least for a while.
Yeah.
And you describe this isolation.
Yeah. I mean, you're completely pulled out of your everyday life, but also there's a loss of identity as well. I mean, I worked in an office. I worked 9 to 5. I worked for magazines. There was lots of writing, lots of deadlines. And that's who I was. I was, you know, I was a writer. And then suddenly I was still a writer, but that wasn't, you know, something that I was allowed or should really focus on. So, by my own choice, I mean, so there was this whole, I mean, trying to, you know, I guess re-educate yourself into being like someone completely different, and also dealing with, you know, the typical first-time parent situations that you have no idea what to do most of the time. I mean, that was that's very stressful. And I mean, I like to say that I really loved being a mom. I was overwhelmed and excited and, you know, euphoric about it. But like in retrospect, I think I was just absolutely horrified, and my brain was telling me that I was enjoying it. But and I think the question was like, why is it moms specifically? I don't think it's a, you know, we're more vulnerable population, but at the same time perhaps we are, because of this idea of isolation. I think in the past there was this whole idea of, you know, having a village to help you raise the child. You know, there were relatives and people closer to you, and now suddenly it's just one parent at home. You know.
Yeah, one of the things, we were at a conference this week, and people were talking about the definition of trauma is when, you know, you can't perform your old roles.
Mm-hmm.
And in some way, you know, I mean, this is like the biggest change. I mean, you were a competent human being. I mean, I'm just speaking from my experience. I was a competent human being. I ran things. And all of a sudden, it's like, I can't even take a shower.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the places I think where you might have gotten checks, both of you, where somebody would say, hey, you know, you're late for work a lot or all that kind of stuff. The people running your kingdom are not able to, I mean, who you're running the kingdom for, mm-hmm. are not able to tell you that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the isolation, you know, there's only you and there's not mm-hmm. like a flock of grandmothers.
And having to keep up appearances, I think. We talked about that the other day. It's like, just having, like, hey, I'm the perfect mom.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler, you were talking about that, of just keeping up with the Joneses and having to maintain this appearance mm-hmm. of being a great mom, because that's what society programs us for.
Yeah, and I also think that this was touched on before, was that for me, staying home with my children, I felt was not only a choice, but it was also a great gift. Mm-hmm. I felt really, really lucky to be able to spend time with my children, because not everybody gets to do that. So the fact that I was overwhelmed and, frankly, very unhappy, I mean, I loved my children dearly, but I was not sort of being satisfied the way I had been professionally, was confusing.
We're talking about alcoholism, we're talking about motherhood, and our guests are Jowita Bydlauska. She's the author of the wonderful book and memoir, Drunk Mom, and Tyler H., who's also a mom in recovery. Jowita, I was, you know, when I was reading your book, I was wondering, gosh, are there any underlying issues here? Is there like co-occurring mental health stuff here? And you, I think it's on page 134, you address anxiety. Could you read, I thought it was a great description of like, yeah, of course I'm anxious. And, you know, but I'm not sure if you ever connected the dots.
Yeah, I will. I can speak to that in a minute. So this is me sitting in a very reluctantly in the office of a counselor who's a lovely man, and he's trying to help me, but I'm not lovely myself at all at that time. So we're talking. Yeah, I think he asked if I'm suffering from anxiety, and I say, well, I am very, very anxious, I say, all the time. I used to take Ativan. It really works for me. Can you talk to my doctor about it? My hands tingle and freeze, and half of my face spasms from anxiety. Feels like I'm always sitting on the edge of my seat, figuratively and literally. You see, because anxious people like me, they can never sit still, so they sit on edges. I'm definitely suffering from anxiety. What's the one short paragraph from that particular visit?
Did you make the connection between... There might be a connection between your drinking and your anxiety?
Sure, I've made many, many connections. And later on in the book, there's a chapter called Archaeology where
that's a beautiful chapter.
Thanks. All these, many possible reasons, genetic components, other mental health issues, things like that. And the reason why I list them all, and I didn't really count, but there's definitely more than a dozen reasons of why I possibly... I'm an addict, is because I don't really know, so I'm not sure if I'm not an expert in addiction. I'm just sharing my own experience, but I can't really speak to, concurrent disorders as being something that's, common. For me it is, but, I don't know if that's, I can't tell if it's, if it was my mental health issues first and then addiction. Addiction is a mental health issue as well, but, or if it was addiction that, helped to have some of those issues manifest. I mean, I can't really speculate on that. So,
Tyler, can you tell us a little about where your real hard drinking falls in the span of your marriage and your motherhood and all that?
Well, for me, it was a little bit of a perfect storm. My marriage started to sort of disintegrate while my two older children were quite little. And while that was sort of falling apart, my drinking really took off. And that was primarily because, I just really did not have the tools. I was not equipped to manage the wave of emotions or feelings that was happening to me at that time. Essentially at the time, I really felt as if my entire world was imploding, as if the safety net that I had created, this beautiful picture I had just painted for you and for the rest of the world, was falling apart, and I had no way to manage that. So I went right to alcohol as a way to relieve that. But I'd like to preface that by saying I believe I was born an alcoholic. It's something that runs in my family. So I was very much aware of that as being something that could possibly happen to me.
Well, I think one of the anthropology, archaeology, whatever, at the very end, it's written like the rest of the book. It's like this is why it happened. Oh, this is why it happened. And it's so beautiful because I think you explore absolutely, you know, 90% of the options, and any of them, any one of them could have been the reasons.
And there could have been none of them, you know, yeah. And it still could have happened.
And I think it's so interesting because there's always underlying issues. You know, people come in, you're like, oh, that's why. But there's always underlying issues.
But we also know, oh, go ahead, Yulita.
Well, I just think that the reason why we want to have a reason is because I think it gives the illusion that we'll be able to fix it, right? Like once we can pinpoint, you know, oh, it's genetics, or it's address
that. Tyler's nodding.
Or it's something else. And that comes from fear, and I think that's perfectly reasonable to try to find, you know, the source of addiction. And Tyler says, you know, in her case it was genetic. In my case, neither my parents or my grandparents had any, you know, alcohol issues. So, you know, that's baffling to me. I mean, why me? Why, you know,
right.
Why so intensely? Like, I have no idea. So,
well, and when you start getting help. I mean, you're talking to counselors, and there's this scene on page 77 where you're explaining why you're not asking for help.
Okay.
I don't ask for help.
77, okay. I don't ask for help because I'm scared. Also too proud. Admitting that I am in trouble doesn't mean asking for help. It means asking to be shunned. Am I not the queen of this country? Don't the people trust me with ruling it responsibly and with love? Don't they ask me to stop being destructive? Am I not given 100 chances? Asking for help means there will be consequences, and they will be dire. My mind, fogged with drink, anxiety, and mental illness, tells me the worst. For example, I often envision my boyfriend packing my bags, kicking me out to live on the street. Seeing police cars on the street can mean that I'm about to go to jail. My sister's worried mouth means she is secretly plotting to have me locked up in a psych ward. This is not me. Me? I'm just a mom. I want so badly to be a good mom. Please don't get mad. Please don't get mad. Look at me. I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm being a mom. And I hope that maybe they're thinking, we're not mad. We're not sending her away. She is a mom. She wouldn't do that to her child, would she? She would. She does.
Oh, that's amazing. So that's why you didn't get help, and that's explaining it. But you did eventually get help. Can you talk about, you know, seeking it out and sure. finally what worked?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it all the time, God, why it works, because I am surrounded by people who are still, you know, actively using, and lots of friends, and it breaks my heart. So I think, why can't you just do it? Like, I'm exactly like the people around me, you know, thinking, why can't you just snap out of it? So it's good to remind myself that a lot of the time, like during my relapse, I wanted to have something or someone do it for me. You know, I didn't want to do the work. So, but I certainly was willing to try anything, because I went to those harm reduction groups. I spoke to a counselor. I went to, you know, a short-term rehab. I went back to meetings. And none of it worked because I was not 100% invested. So it's sort of... I guess it's a disappointing thing to say, you know, it's not going to work until you're really in it. But that's what it was like for me. I mean, I had to understand that there were two choices. One was to continue lying and you know, deal with consequences. And I possibly would have been able to lie for a few more months, if not years. I mean, who knows? I was a very...
You were pretty resourceful.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know... I had a concussion. I did this and that. You know, it's like I can. I'm a writer. I come up with stories.
Yeah.
There's no. You know. There's no stopping me. But and then there was the other sort of thing, which was, you know, I come clean. I stop lying, and I do the work. And I deal with the consequences, because I didn't know when I was, you know, when I was telling people about drinking in secret, and when I was sort of coming out as an alcoholic. To all the people that already knew that, but, you know, me admitting it, I didn't know what the consequences were going to be, and that seemed like less of a burden than having to lie and you know, and play the game. So this is a very roundabout way of saying that, you know, that anything will work when you decide it's time to stop lying, or mostly to yourself.
Exactly.
Tyler, I'm wondering how you came to get help.
It took me a very, very long time. I sought help for a number of years, sort of in a very sort of half-baked way. I didn't really, I went to meetings because I think it was expected of me, but I really, my heart wasn't in it. I was not being truthful. For me, I needed to have some pretty scary things happen. I needed to have some very dire consequences presented to me, and I needed to have some sober time. So it took me probably about 3 or 4 months of being sober before I actually made the decision and I actually was able to surrender and say, I'm an alcoholic.
I'm interested when we come back from our break about learning just kind of what extra challenges being a mother and seeking treatment and being in recovery present.
Talk now, and this is my favorite part, about what unique problems and benefits have you found as women in recovery and going to meetings and all those fun things. And Yuita, especially for you, what is the fallout from this book? And Tyler, what's the fallout from telling people? So Yuita, tell us.
it's been I expected a lot of, you know, negative feedback because we have all this stigma about addiction, especially, you know, mothers, parents who drink. But I was really surprised to find how much positive feedback there was. So I like to say it was, you know, 80% positive, 20% negative, as expected, with anything, I think, you know.
That's actually better than I expected.
But I'm sure even Martha Stewart, you know, gets in trouble for you know, her lovely recipes, she gets some negative feedback. So it was really, really surprising how well people responded. And I've gotten lots of emails from men, women, from adult children of alcoholics. I recently got an email. It was like an essay, like a life story of a woman in her 20s who wrote simply just to share her story about growing up with a mom who drank. She didn't ask for an email back. She just said, I'm just writing to let you know that if you hadn't stopped, this is what it might have looked like. So a lovely gift, you know. She took her time to write it. There's just been a lot of that. Contrary to what it may seem, having published a memoir, I'm quite a private, introverted person, so I had to really face a lot of fears of, you know, talking about my addiction in public, even after, you know, having the book come out and having people come up to me, to share their stories. And in terms of negative feedback, I mean, I find that's probably the most the biggest teaching moments are the negative, you know, feedback or emails, because it's one of those things where I think, you know, this is coming from somewhere. This is coming from lack of knowledge or personal fear, or you know, or there's something we're not doing as a society to talk about this issue because it's so scary to someone that they have to, you know, call me names or send me, you know, threatening emails and things like that. And that's, I took some things personally, but then I stopped because it's such a complicated issue. And because there was never a moment where I felt, you know, I was particularly brave or special because I wrote this book. I mean, I could just tell the story, and I still question my decision to tell the story so publicly. And, you know, it's something I will have to discuss with my son, of course, as he grows up. But overall, it's been good.
You know, that speaks, the way society reacts to it speaks of the stigma, just this whole subject. Motherhood is seen as this sacred,
idyllic
thing. And you know, piercing the holes into that vision is going to be risky. But I'm wondering how you maintain your sobriety, what you do as a mother and now as, you know, a published author. How do you do that?
I attend an agnostic Alcoholic Anonymous meeting. That's just a personal, you know, choice and belief or lack of belief. Mm-hmm. But that's what works for me, and I have been doing that for the past few years. You know, I have a great home group, lots of people who are sober around me. So that's kind of what keeps me in check. And I am surrounded by, I would say, like 90% of my friends are, you know, sober alcoholics. Some are not sober, but that's yeah. who I'm around. So it's always good reminders, and when I feel myself in trouble, I have people I can talk to. So, and just on personal level, I mean, I'm aware of my addiction every single day. There's not a moment where I give myself a little break. I mean, this summer I went to Poland, where I'm from, to visit, and there was a very brief moment where I thought, oh, I'm going there, no one knows me there,
They don't drink in Poland, do they?
There's no alcoholics in Poland. It's a great
That's right.
I don't think they even, it's one of those places where it's just, you don't ever talk about it. So
right.
One of the reasons why I didn't publish my book in Polish, because it's too much. So, but I went there and I thought, nobody knows me. I can maybe have a drink. And,
yeah.
As soon as that thought entered my mind, it left my mind. But so I have that second of grace now.
Tyler, how do you stay sober? What do you do? How do you keep it going as a mom?
Well, I keep it front and center, and I go to a meeting a day. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous has been the solution to my sobriety. On top of that, I personally have had to have a very sort of structured day. I find that very, very helpful. So I start my morning the same way every day, and I end my day the same way every day. I think also just very simple tools about mindfulness and just slowing down during the course of the day and being more aware of and listening to myself. In terms of my children, I had to make the very difficult decision to put my sobriety first with my children. And they know that there are times when I have to leave to go to a meeting. And it's actually gotten to the point where they say, now, Mom, please go to a meeting. Because they understand that I need it and that it's better for everybody. And that our household is a much happier household. When I'm working my program.
Well, I just want to thank you guys for being on the show tonight. Drunk Mom, a memoir by Jowita Bydlauska, is available on Amazon. It's on Penguin Books here in the States. I'm not sure about Canada. Jowita, thanks so much for taking time out. We look forward to more writing from you because you have the
thanks
gift.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being on. And Tyler H., thank you so much for your insight. It was great. Both of you guys were just very helpful to me
in
kind of looking at that perspective. You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.